From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the research labs at the University of Rochester, where cloaking is actually happening. We're talking about invisibility, but perhaps not in the way you might expect. This is not quite the movies, not quite Harry Potter's invisibility cloak. It's using off-the-shelf optics to conceal objects that are right in front of us. Cloaking and how to make something invisible and the practical application of doing so. That's the starting point for our discussion in our monthly science roundtable. My guests for this hour include University of Rochester's Joseph Choi. He's a PhD student there. And Joe, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to talk to you about what you've been working on. And John Howell is a professor of physics and the director of the Center for Coherence and Quantum Optics. Professor, I hope I've got that right.
Yeah, sounds good.
We're going to be talking about exactly what that is and what you do in detail coming up. I want to start with a conversation with a colleague, mathematician and professor of mathematics, Alan Greenlee from the University of Rochester, has done some work in this regard in a little bit of a different way. And so let's start with the conversation I had this morning with Professor Greenlee. I wanted to start that conversation with why we in the media are always so fascinated with this subject.
You know, I think it's something which, you know, people have thought about for millennia. You go back to the Greek myths, you look at science fiction, you look at fiction. It's just something which people have always wanted to do. I guess it's a basic human desire to become invisible. We all do once in a while. And if, in fact, science is able to provide some realistic route to doing that, then it sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, and, you know, I've even heard from some listeners who are excited we're doing this conversation today, and others who say they think this is sort of junk science or pseudoscience. And, you know, here's an email from a listener who says, I couldn't help but chuckle and even cringe when you said you were going to cover this subject on the Science Roundtable. There have been something like a dozen scientists and groups working on this stuff going on years. The theme almost all universally the same. It's cloaking only to microwave radiation, and even then in a hyper-narrow frequency range, and all of them, I believe, are two-dimensional. There will never be, even in the far future, a large-scale application. Is that too cynical?
It's not too cynical. I would say that there has been a fair amount of publicity, a fair amount of hype. There are some very interesting laboratory experiments that have been done, but it is certainly true that what you might call free space, three-dimensional cloaking for visible light of macroscopic objects like people or planes and so on, that probably is far in the future and may in fact never happen. I think, you know, the listeners should realize that science progresses in fits and starts, and in the last decade, there's really been a tremendous burst of interest in this, not necessarily for cloaking per se, but because cloaking is maybe one of the more extreme versions of a line of research that's going on, which may have applications that are not as sexy as invisibility cloaking, but may have very interesting engineering applications, perhaps biomedical applications. So one just needs to realize that whenever there is progress, there is a publicity machine that kicks in sometimes, which maybe gets ahead of the science a little bit. But it's not junk science. I mean, there's very serious progress both in theoretical physics and engineering that has really been quite remarkable over the last decade. Can we cloak somebody today? No.
Throughout this hour, and especially later with some of your colleagues, we are going to be talking about practical application. But let me ask you, just in terms of your own research, you know, it's interesting. When I talk to researchers in various fields, the question of practical application comes up, and I wonder how high on your priority list it is. And I don't mean that cynically. I mean that I'm very curious to know about when you're going into this kind of a project, are you thinking first and foremost about practical application?
No, and in fact, actually, if I could just sort of take a slight detour, you know, I'm a mathematician, I'm not a physicist or an engineer.
Sure.
And the way I got involved in this was extremely indirect. So let me just back up a little bit. So I think everyone can agree that there are various kinds of imaging that are very, very important. We go to the hospital, we go to the doctor's office, we go to the dentist, and we appreciate that people can take x-rays, they can look inside of our teeth or inside of our bodies without having to actually cut into us. Diagnostic imaging is important. Screening imaging is important. There's a whole area of mathematics which is devoted to trying to understand how you can look inside of objects without actually taking them apart or even destroying them. And this is important for medicine. It's important for seismology, for exploring for oil, all sorts of reasons you want to be able to look inside of things without destroying them. And there's an area of mathematics called inverse problems, which is devoted to this. Now, inverse problems has a range of people working on it. Some are very, very implied. Some people are, you know, do computer coding. I'm at the theoretical end of inverse problems. And there are a number of basic foundational things you would want to know about whenever you scan something. You scan a person, you scan a manufactured part looking for defects. You want to know, can you actually tell what's inside of it or not? Could there be actually different kinds of things inside the human body? Could there be both healthy tissue and tumors, which might actually look the same to whatever imaging technique that you're using? So in mathematics, we call this a uniqueness theorem. If, in fact, there's only one possible thing inside the body that is consistent with the measurements that you're making. And 10 years ago, I was working with a couple of other people, Matti Lassus, who's now at the University of Helsinki, and Gunter Ullmann, who's at the University of Washington in Seattle. And we were looking at this from a fairly theoretical point of view, and we were basically concerned, is it possible that, for example, you might be trying to look inside of a person to look for example, a cancerous tumor, and could it be that there'd be some kinds of tumors that would be indistinguishable from healthy tissue? And if you phrase this as a theoretical mathematical problem, it's quite interesting. You can look at it for its own sake without any intended application, but eventually, yes, you would like to go back to people who actually do this kind of thing in the laboratory and say, either we have good news, which is that your measurements can determine what's inside the person, or we have bad news. In fact, there are different kinds of things which might give you the same measurements. And in fact, what we came up with in 2003 was actually what we considered to be sort of a curiosity, but we found that there were distributions of matter, in particular things with different kinds of electrical conductivity, which would be indistinguishable from simply having a solid piece of matter, all of which look the same. So at the time, we did not think of this in terms of a cloaking device. We thought of this simply as a counterexample to a certain problem in mathematics, and we worked on it. We published a couple papers, and we moved on to other projects. It was only 3 years later when some friends who were aware of our work told us that, in fact, some physicists had done something very similar, that we then returned to the subject of cloaking. Because, in fact, originally, we hadn't even thought of it as cloaking.
We're talking to Alan Greenleaf, professor of mathematics from the University of Rochester, and talking about detours here. I had read that back in 2007, I think it's the same group that you mentioned, Gunter Ullmann, Yaroslav Kurilev, and... Right. And you worked on wormholes back in 2007 as well?
Right. So it turns out that actually the basic idea behind cloaking, so I guess I should say, actually backing up a little bit, in 2005, 2006, independently, a number of different groups in physics and engineering came forward with serious, you know, not junk science proposals for different kinds of invisibility devices or coatings. And these things are distinct from the stealth technology, which is very familiar from the military. These really are somewhat different. These are dependent on different kinds of theoretical ideas. So one of the basic approaches, which then really has taken off since 2006, is based on a technical tool that's called transformation optics. And transformation optics is basically a way of designing blueprints for devices. It doesn't tell you how to build them, but gives you sort of the schematic blueprints for devices that have very strange effects on light waves or other kinds of waves. And it turns out that cloaking may only be one of, and maybe not even the most interesting, application of transformation optics. So in 2007, we wrote this paper where we described an object that we called an electromagnetic wormhole. And you shouldn't think, although we use the word wormhole, which has connotations coming from general relativity and from science fiction, basically what this is, if one could build it, and it's a very complicated thing to build, it would be a device which, when you send light rays past it or microwaves or whatever your favorite kind of wave is, basically it tricks the waves into thinking that they're not moving through standard three-dimensional space, but they're moving through three-dimensional space that has some wormholes attached to it, which mathematically means you change the topology of space. So we think this is a really neat idea. We're very proud of it. It would be extremely complicated to build, and given the current state of the materials which are used to implement cloaking devices and other kinds of transmission optics devices, it may be some time before such things actually can be built, even in a laboratory setting. But I think it's important for people to come up with theoretical proposals in order to motivate the actual engineers who are actually building things, if they have a strong motivation to build a device, because it seems that it would be very striking if they could actually build it. That gives people the motivation to actually work harder on these problems.
Building a wormhole, as you describe it, would involve what kind of materials?
Okay, so in the last 15 years or so, there's been sort of a revolution in material science. There's a kind of material, there's not just one, but sort of a class of materials, which used to go under the boring name of structured composite materials. And at some point, somebody, I think perhaps a funding director at one of the funding agencies, came up with the name of metamaterials. So a metamaterial is basically a material which owes its physical properties not so much to the atoms and molecules that it's made out of, but actually how it's assembled. So basically it's a material which is dependent on the geometry of how it's constructed into larger and larger structures, rather than simply the atoms and molecules that it's made out of. So if you see pictures of metamaterials, what they basically look like is they look like little boxes, what are called the atoms of the metamaterial, which are assembled into large grids of these boxes. And when a wave, whether it be a microwave or a sound wave or whatever, passes through this material, the geometry of the individual boxes creates effects which make the entire structure have properties which would be very, very hard, if not impossible, to find with natural materials. So in the ordinary material science, you go out there, you find the elements that exist in the universe that you can find on Earth, you make them into more complicated molecules and compounds, and then you build things out of them. But that limits the possibilities. And with metamaterials, you basically have what you might think of as designer materials, where actually, at least in the laboratory, one can construct materials which have physical properties which essentially don't exist in nature. And these metamaterials have been very, very important for trying to implement these designs for cloaking devices and for other interesting results of transformation optics. So in the last 15 years, there's really been a revolution in these metamaterials. Where it's headed is not so clear, because these metamaterials seem to have some intrinsic limitations. In particular, they absorb a lot of energy. So that means they cast a shadow. So if you send a wave through a block of metamaterial, typically a lot of the energy gets absorbed by the metamaterial, and therefore, for example, if you were trying to build a cloaking device out of these metamaterials, it would cast a shadow, which means that actually the cloak is not working perfectly. They also tend, as your emailer said, they tend to work over very narrow bands. So in other words, they might work at one particular frequency of light or microwaves or sound waves, but they might not work at very nearby frequencies. And therefore, you might basically only be able to build a cloak that would work at a very narrow range of wavelengths. Now, actually, Professor Howell, who you'll be speaking to later, his design actually is not based on these metamaterials. It's based on sort of standard optical products, and therefore actually is broadband, which is really interesting, because typically metamaterial designs are intrinsically narrowband, and that's a real limitation.
Well, and I should say before I wrap up with Professor Greenleaf, because when you mentioned wormhole, it was just a week ago on this program we had a discussion with some folks in the science community about just how realistic the film Interstellar is, and they hear the term wormhole, so
right.
And not quite exactly the same thing.
Right.
But how, you know, do you find yourself avoiding those kind of films just so you don't pick it apart all day, or is it sport for you?
Well, no. So I actually, although when I was much younger, I read an enormous amount of science fiction. I tend not to read much science fiction these days. I will see that film at some point. But we use that word basically because we thought it would attract people's attention. And at least to a mathematician, it's clear what we mean, as opposed to constructing some device that could take you to a different part of the universe.
Right.
But there is always a danger when you use a name like that attracts certain kind of attention, that can be a negative, actually. as well.
Well, that's why I wanted to make the clarification.
Yeah, right. we're making no such claim, but it is a design that we are very proud of.
That's mathematician and professor of mathematics Alan Greenleaf from the University of Rochester. That conversation was this morning. We're back live now here on Connections in our monthly science roundtable and in studio for the remainder of the hour. If you're just joining us, Joseph Choi is a PhD student at the University of Rochester, and John Howell is a professor of physics and the director of the Center for Coherence and Quantum Optics. What you just heard Professor Greenleaf describe is a little different than the work that you've been doing, for example, John.
Yes, quite a bit different.
and you know, it's interesting. Right now, University of Rochester put a video out that you can see with Joseph Choi and others demonstrating some of the work you've been doing with cloaking, Joseph. And I would think that there is a world of difference between off-the-shelf optics and metamaterials. First of all, can you explain a little bit about what the difference is, aside from the obvious?
Well, metamaterials is like... the professor said it's artificial materials that are arranged so that you can obtain a specific result, but it provides properties that aren't found in nature. Whereas off-the-shelf optics are made of natural materials, so these are natural properties that you use instead of artificial properties. And what metamaterials do for cloaking is they actually cloak for the full wave nature of light, whereas all we're doing is what's sort of important for the human eye is as long as the directions and the power of the light matches, then you can get some sort of cloaking effect, and that's what the off-the-shelf optics will allow you to do.
All right, so in a moment we're going to talk exactly about the latest developments, but let me also back up and ask both of our guests in studio the same question that I had for Professor Greenleaf, which is just practical application. You know, the reason behind this research. We have fun looking at science fiction, and that's, you know, sort of silly, but John, for example, when you think about cloaking and invisibility, what comes to mind for you immediately when it comes to the ways to apply it?
Well, that's a good question. Physicists tend to be boring in that way because
that's okay.
We tend to look at things from fundamental, and I guess I can talk about that a little bit later, but we wanted to solve a really fundamental problem, not necessarily have a really awesome application. But one of the things that's been interesting to me is as this has gone out, there have been people come to me and say, hey, look what we can do with this, or have you thought about doing this? For example, someone came and asked me if he could design buildings based on cloaking. Could he make the top few levels of a building disappear, or the middle? Could he cloak a wall so that he didn't have to put a window there? Just because that is very desirable, because you don't want heat to go in and out of walls, and a window is not a very good insulator. So if you could cloak a wall, then you could replace a very poor insulator with a very good insulator and have a very cheap alternative, hopefully.
All right, so there's an immediate practical application. And Joe, you've talked about application for the surgical community, for other aspects. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so one of the first applications that we suggested was, you know, you can make the surgeon's hand disappear or make it see-through so the surgeon can use their instruments without being obstructed with their hand. But I mean, that could be a little difficult to put lenses on the surgeon's hand and make it work, right? So it might be a bit of a difficult job to make it work or engineered so that it works. But you could also make the back of your truck disappear, a see-through, so you can maybe see through blind spots. I think for that it might be a little more doable because you could probably use smaller lenses for that. One of the other applications I think could happen is you can have just fun applications. One thing that my advisor, Professor Howell, suggested was you could even just make a billboard appear as if it's levitating by making the post that holds it disappear and see through. And that could be done relatively easily, I think, with cheaper optics.
For the sake of just being more conspicuous or gathering more attention?
I guess that would work, yeah, unless everyone starts doing it.
Pure fun.
Yeah, pure fun. But in terms of the difference between what Professor Greenleaf has talked about and their research, take us through what you both have been working on specifically. And this is where we have a lot of fun in actually diving into the actual science of it. I mean, I want to talk about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and the way those kind of questions impact trying to create cloaking. So why don't we start with you, John? Tell me about sort of the path of research that you have followed on this.
Yeah, so a few years ago, there was an experimental apparatus where they showed that they could temporally cloak, which is they could hide an event in time.
Hide an event?
Hide an event, a temporal event, an event in time. And I looked at the experimental apparatus, and there is a one-to-one analog between what they were doing in time to what I thought, well, you could just do this in space using lenses and propagation of light. And after that realization, I thought, there's probably very simple ways of hiding large things that hadn't really thought about to this point. So as I started thinking about it, when we talk about smoke and mirrors, really making things invisible has been going on for a very long time, that people are using distraction, illusion, all sorts of things to make you think that something isn't there when in reality it is there. So all I did was I said, okay, there's this really simple experiment that exists for hiding something in time. Can we make a similar thing for hiding something in space? And it was simply over a Thanksgiving holiday 2 years ago that I did this with a few of my boys. I have 5 boys, and we were demonstrated that there were simple ways to guide light around an object. We took a couple of L-shaped swimming fish tanks, and we showed that we could guide light around it, and the boys had just a blast showing that light could, their arm could disappear or something along that line. We took a couple of lenses and did similar things, and then we used a standard technique, which is just to take a bunch of mirrors and using mirrors guide the light around an object to make it look as if the object isn't there. So that's really what got me thinking about this. But there's an open question in invisibility. And if you think about the Harry Potter cloak, this would be a scientific terminology. It's broadband omnidirectional. And what that means is, and what Professor Greenleaf was talking about, was broadband just means you can look at the entire color spectrum. And for example, our eyes see from about 350 nanometers to 750 nanometers. Can you make something invisible over that entire wavelength range that our eyes are good at seeing at? And then omnidirectional just means, can you make it invisible no matter how you look at it? If I look at
it— No matter where you're in the room.
Yes. So if I'm looking in one direction, right, I want it to be invisible. If I'm looking from another direction, I want it to be invisible. And there's very easy ways to make something look invisible from a single direction. But can you make something invisible from every direction? And that's a really—
Is that the big hurdle?
If you could do that, you would have a very important breakthrough. And so as physicists, we said, well, that's really hard. Let's break this down into something less difficult. Can we make a broadband, which means over the entire visible spectrum of the eyes, and multidirectional, which means, and continuously multidirectional, which means that over a range of angles that you don't see something. So it isn't just in one specific direction, but in multiple directions. And if you can do that, then that's also something relatively straightforward. So Joe and I started working on a project where he said, let's think about a broadband, multi-directional invisibility device, and can we go from there? And that's where we came up with this lens system.
All right, now, before we even get into multi-directional, Joe, you hear John say it's easy to do, sort of looking down the line at one thing. That's not multidirectional. That's
unidirectional.
All right, unidirectional is easy?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are very easy ways to do that. One thing is just you take a camera right in front of you, you have a laptop, and you just project what you see in front of you. It works just for one direction. If you go to the side, it won't work. But that's a very easy way to do some sort of cloaking effect.
Again, that is... bending the light or give me
if I'm trying to you're in front of me, Evan, and I put a laptop in between you and me, and then I just have the screen project what the camera sees, so it just projects your image onto the screen, and if I angle it right, then it appears as if you're gone. Or I can make you disappear. I could project the wall behind you instead of you. So then you would disappear in front of me. But if I move, then I can start to see that, oh, this is a laptop or a camera's work in here. So it works for one direction. That's a really easy way to do that just with any electronics you have currently.
Okay. And so taking your knowledge on how to do that, how do you move in the multi-directional? How do you make that happen?
Want me to answer?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so Professor...
You're the student, you're being graded here, Joe.
Okay, all right, hopefully I'll do a good job. So Professor Howell and his sons, they provided interesting ways to actually do this with one direction for large objects. You know, they hid a human being. So what they were trying to do is also, well, what Professor Howell was trying to do is he was trying to see a continuously multidirectional. So if you change angles, would it work? And he came up with the design, and I just he just suggested, Joe, why don't you try to make this work? And I tried to optimize it. And when we did that, I just first thought about, okay, if I wanted to, it seemed to work, first of all. And then I just wanted to optimize it, make it work better for larger angles. And when I did that, I thought, what's the first thing that you want to do when you try to improve something? We go back to the simplest theory to model it. And I'm an optics student, so I took lens design, and one of my professors said the first thing that you ever do when you try to make an optical system is you try to match the first order design. This just means that the simplest theory you use and you try to make it work for that. So then we took that, and it uses ABCD matrices, just four numbers to describe an optical system, and you just try to match that. And if you try to match that, I first had to describe what it means to be a cloaking device. So the two things that we came up with was, first, it needs to make something invisible. So it needs to have some space to make an object disappear. The other thing is it needs to make it so that what you see after the background needs to be transmitted as if the optical system isn't there. So basically, if I put a cloaking device around you, if I look at the device, it should appear as if it's just empty space, that it's not there. And it should have some space so that the lights don't hit it, and then that object will be invisible. So those were the two things, is you want some space so that an object is invisible in that cloaking device, and then you want the cloaking device itself to disappear and act as if it's just empty space. And optically, that just means you have you can describe empty space optically. It's very simple. And then that's when we said, okay, you want to make an optical system, if you have lenses or mirrors or whatever you have, you want that to match empty space of the same length. And then you want to make sure that there's space where the light's bend so it doesn't reach. And then you have a cloaking region. So if you satisfy those two, then you have a first order cloaking device that inherently, the theory is multidirectional. It just works for a small range of angles, but it's still a continuous range of angles. And so you just fit that theory, and then the first design seemed to work. And then Professor Howell suggested, let's try to make it even simpler, see if you can just use lenses. And we discovered, yes, you can do that. You just need four lenses, and you just need to separate them. And then the whole system acts as if it's empty space, and still it has some regions where the light doesn't enter, so you can put a hand or a finger in there and hide it.
Is it working the way you expected, John?
Yes. I think there's a nice way to think about this. We have a really fundamental, deep intuition about how light behaves. When we see light coming from a distant object, we think it's propagated, or we think it's come in a straight line to us. Mm-hmm. And essentially, what we're doing is our fundamental belief is that light has gone in a straight line from whatever we're seeing to our eyes, and so we believe that that object is where it is. Now, all essentially what Joe's talked about it is, he says, well, we have this fundamental intuition about how light moves. Can we take these lenses and craft a design that exactly matches our intuition for how light propagates? And it turns out that there is that design, that it's a fairly simple four-lens system that exactly replicates how light propagates in a normal system. if you ever watched an old Bugs Bunny cartoon as a little kid, I loved watching Bugs Bunny, but I always noticed that the background moved in a way that was different than how I was normally thinking about background. If we move our head side to side and we look at background, things that are close seem to move differently than things that are far away. And as Bugs Bunny is walking across the screen, we see the background all move together. Everything moves mm-hmm. uniformly. And as we've become more sophisticated in our cartoons, then we see all of the depths move as we expect that they move. You know, something that's 100 feet away or 100 meters away or 100, kilometers, right? Everything we expect moves mm-hmm. as the way we expect. And so the beautiful thing about and that's because we have this deep intuition about how things should move as we move our head side to side or as we're moving relative to other things. And this cloaking device does that, which is the background moves as you expect the background to move. And that's really an important thing, because if you start moving your head side to side, you would immediately give that away in another type of system.
So it's not giving you an inaccurate view of what is at distance, in other words.
Yes.
Which would be a bug of the system, wouldn't it?
Yes. So you see the background move as your deeply held intuition would tell you.
Really interesting stuff. I see some of your questions coming in on social media, text and email. And if you want to call the program with questions, you can do that. It's toll free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We've got John Howell and Joseph Choi from the University of Rochester talking about cloaking and real, actual application, not just sort of science fiction. This is real life stuff and our monthly science roundtable. Let's take a 60-second break and your questions answered next. Coming up in our second hour, James Lawrence joins me for the full hour. He is retiring this week after 22 years as the editor of the editorial page for the Democrat and Chronicle. We talked to James Lawrence about his career, the future of the newspaper industry, race relations in Rochester, and so much more. James Lawrence, next hour on Connections.
Marijuana legalization has put high-quality made-in-the-USA pot on store shelves, which is tough competition for the Mexican supply.
It's grown in bulk outdoors. It's typically dried but not really cured, which is something we do here in the U.S. with connoisseur quality cannabis.
Hard times in Mexico's marijuana heartland later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your public radio station.
Welcome back to our monthly Science Roundtable. If you're just joining us, we're talking about cloaking, invisibility, and the ways to achieve that, and then how it might be used. And there are a couple of different sort of angles with this. Earlier this hour, we talked to Professor of Mathematics Alan Greenlee from the University of Rochester, and one of our listeners wanted to know if the previous conversation with Professor Greenlee would have application to work in photonics. And I don't know much about photonics, but John Howell, do you want to, again, I know it might not be your bailiwick, but I'm curious to know if you want to address that one.
So I'm not an expert in transformation optics. I do know the basic math behind it. But I know that there are people that are interested in using these metamaterials for doing things such as super lenses, which is being able to focus light better than the diffraction limit. I know that there's a whole host of things that people are looking into using these super metamaterials. It's actually quite an elegant field that I've really enjoyed looking into myself. A lot of beautiful mathematics. I haven't looked in deeply into what the applications are beyond cloaking.
Bill writes, I'm having a hard time understanding just how far along your guests are with what they are doing. And I think what Bill is referring to is just the question on, I hope I'm right, Bill, call the program if I'm wrong. I think what he's saying is he's hearing you discuss multi-directional cloaking and some success you've had. But I think what Bill's asking is, does that mean that how far along the line are you in terms of actual omnidirectional, is that the term you use, John? Cloaking, in terms of being able to stand anywhere in a room, look through an object in the middle, and again, that's probably the wrong term, but look past it, I guess, with a cloaking device. How far along are you? I'll start with you, Joe.
Oh, I was expecting Professor Howell to answer this because he has a lot of good ideas. Well, the theory for the that we propose, which is called paraxial ray optics cloaking. So again, we're just talking about rays, directions, and power of light. And then paraxial just means it's small angles. Theoretically, that just means up to maybe plus or minus 15 degrees, so about a 30 degree angle it should work. Some people suggest maybe even plus or minus 30 degrees, so 60 degrees. So it's not actually that small. 30 degrees is not that small, but if you want to go to the side, you'd be able to see all the lenses or whatever setup you have, as you can see in our video. So our theory works for small angles, but to do omnidirectional, you'd probably need to do something drastically different.
The video is pretty cool, and later today, after the program, I'll post it on Twitter, at Evan Dawson on Twitter, so you can kind of see. They did a little demonstration, and it is very neat to see, but then what are the barriers? If you can get to, you say 30 degrees, essentially, how do you get to 180 degrees?
It is possible.
360 degrees. Yeah.
But I'm in the process of working towards a patent on it, so I can't really talk about it.
Okay. But you're here to tell us that your work has determined that it is not impossible, and that in fact it's the opposite is true, that there is a path to getting this done.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Can you give us a timeline for how far along on the patent scale you might be?
I can't, unfortunately.
Okay. How do I ask this? How do I get answers out of a guest?
So let me just say
what's everything that you could possibly tell us without getting yourself in any legal trouble, John?
So let me just say that one of the things that we've done with this four-lens system is we have the lens system that we used in the video, and that was only a couple degrees, 2 or 3 degrees, but Edmund Optics actually donated some A-spheres to us, and we were able to improve that quite a bit. So able to go over quite a bit larger range of angles. I'm not sure what it is. Do you have an estimate?
Yeah, I didn't actually measure, but it was pretty significant because with the Edmund Optics A-spheres, I was able to get right up close to the lenses and still see the cloaking effect, whereas the original four lens, you had to be about a meter away to be able to see a decent cloaking effect. The drawback with the A-spheres is that you sacrifice on the image quality. If you want to increase the field of view without paying too much in lens prices, then you usually sacrifice on the quality of image that comes through. The Rochester Cloak video shows the grids being shown really clearly, but with the other version that we built, you don't see that as clearly. You could probably improve that. You could do a lot of improvements with optical engineering. It just costs a lot more money to do.
Let me get to the phones. This is Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, go ahead.
Hi. As a blind person, I have a question about things being invisible. It seems to me there's three components to the problem. One is the physics of the light, the other is the mechanics of the eye, and the third is the perception of the mind. And so which of these three areas, or are you working on all three of these areas, or am I totally off base? Thanks very much.
Oh, that was good. Yeah, this guy's good. Basically, we're working on all three of those things, but basically you're trying to deal with someone's intuition about how things behave, and you're essentially manipulating that when you're doing, you can think of cloaking as essentially an optical illusion, and you're doing that, but it also deals with how the propagation of light goes, that you have to be able to manipulate light correctly in order to get the effect that you're hoping for. So it's really a combination of all of those things. I forgot his second point. What was his second?
I thought you answered all of that.
Okay, so it was propagation of light and
perception.
Well, Christina wants to know if your guests have considered any negative implications of their work in this field.
Yes. I mean, I would hate to see this used in a bad way. I can only imagine that anytime you bring in stealth, that can become problematic if you use it for the wrong reasons.
Joe?
Yeah, I've had some questions asked about, you know, could people use this for bad purposes, and I've sort of answered them. I don't think the cloaking technology is that great now to the point where you wouldn't really be able to detect someone using it. But later down the road, it could be. But even then, there are detection methods to be able to detect someone that might be using cloaking technology. That Professor Howell has a lot of good ideas for that as well.
To some degree, I think when it comes to science and application of science, I do think there are ethical questions we should always ask. But at the same time, you know, you would hopefully not project negative intentions for people, Professor Howell.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want anything that I developed to become a very bad source of, you know, doing bad, I think, on the civilization or the community. So, there's probably always positive and negatives to everything. I think the internet, for example, is a wonderful tool. It's used for good and it's used for bad. But you wouldn't necessarily not develop the internet from that.
Right. If you knew what was going to come out of it, right. If you're just joining us, then maybe what we can do is let people know again what we do think the practical applications can be. And some of it, John is telling us that we can't know everything that's going on because of patents and laws, et cetera. But, you know, Joe, we've talked about it, and let's hit it again here. If things work in this way, the way you want them to, mm-hmm. You've talked about surgical application. Again, maybe difficult, but there's a possibility. You've talked about blind spots in cars, et cetera. Kind of go over those points again, and anything else in your mind that would be a positive application.
Right. I think inventors or also optical engineers will be able to improve on or come up with new ideas that are more practical. But you could possibly make a surgeon's hand see through, so when he or she is doing surgery, the hand wouldn't be obstructing his view of the surgery region. Or you could make blind spots appear by just making whatever's obstructing that view transparent or cloaked. Or like Professor Howell suggested, you can make a wall into a window instead by using lenses and just having a small hole in the wall, so you could save on insulation costs.
John, anything else stand out to you for application?
Well, one of the things that Professor Greenleaf was talking about was actually imaging non-destructively. I think that's a really important thing. Can we image around something that you don't want, are not interested in, and see something that you are interested in? I think that's a very important problem, and one that I think would have probably tremendous ramifications even in biological imaging.
Martin writes to us that, Evan, you mentioned Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Don't be afraid to give us a little depth on this subject. There are certainly issues that would seem to me to prevent this from being done because of that. I think what Martin is probably saying is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is something that, I don't want to get too technical and have our listeners' ears glaze over, but I think it's also interesting to me that you're trying to work around problems that for a while look like they might not be doable, John. For example, when it comes to the question of momentum and position, you know, we can talk about conjugate variables, for example, and we can probably try to do that in a way that is understandable for people.
Yes.
How do you do that?
So anytime you try to cloak something, you have to preserve two things. And you basically hit on them, which is momentum and position. When you are, for example, projecting something, you are projecting various positions. But as Joe is saying, if you move off that initial direction, you have changed your momentum, and which basically means that you're looking things from a different direction. And momentum isn't just simply, we normally think of momentum as some sort of massive object, but momentum in terms of light is often simply just the direction that you're associated with that. Well, if you know anything about it, momentum, it's actually a vector, which means it has both magnitude and direction, and we're interested in the direction as far as light is concerned. And so if you try to preserve both the spatial relationship and the momentum relationship of various optical rays, then you do have a cost, which is that you can't do better than the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, because the better you know the spatial position of something, the worse you know its momentum.
And there's Bill with a follow-up question. Is cloaking a moving object much more difficult than cloaking a stationary object? Just what we're talking about. I imagine, obviously, for these reasons? The answer is yes.
Yes.
Yeah, obviously for these reasons. But how has that played into? I can't ask you all these questions I want to ask you, John. but how has that played into the challenge of your research, one versus the other, stationary versus moving?
Well, stationary is quite simple, as we were talking about. If the observer and the thing that's being cloaked are stationary relative to each other, then it's very simple to make a system. I can just use mirrors to guide light around that object that you want to cloak. But if I start moving off, then things get much harder. And so I have to, if I have a device that allows me to preserve both space and momentum, then it is possible to have even a moving object be cloaked.
And Jill is asking if we are close to seeing any of this stuff. I'm trying to sorting through her mail. Close to seeing any of this stuff, I will say, to market. John, Joe?
Well, if Joe has $1 million, I could show him how to get it to market.
Okay.
No, it's probably ways away. There's still development, a lot of development that goes into it.
Is that part of the frustrating thing for people in the science and research community, John and Joe? You have folks like me in the media who hear that you're working on cloaking and invisibility. We immediately start putting up sort of caricatured images. We think of Harry Potter, you know, which is not what you're doing necessarily. And we also want to develop a time frame. We hear about cancer cures or cancer research. We hear about all kinds of medical applications. And then we want to speed up a time frame. Is that frustrating for you?
No. I think anyone that sees something that's very exciting wants to get a hold of one themselves as soon as they can. One of the interesting things that came from this is that someone put out a Kickstarter saying that they were going to make a cloak, and that for $75, wasn't it, you could have your own cloak.
If you donated $75 to the Kickstarter, you get the cloak when it's made?
You get your own cloak. But I'm not sure much beyond that what was in it. But I'm doubtful that it's going to be a Harry Potter cloak. But it could be
$75. That would be a steal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You may be waiting a long time.
I was thinking that maybe I should just ask for my own. I'm really curious.
You may be waiting a long time for that to arrive. Is this a competitive field right now? Is there a race to create a real cloaking device that's omnidirectional?
I'm sure. You know, I think probably a lot of these things might be classified. So I'm not sure. I'm sure there is a tremendous amount of interest. I know that there's the defense industry is looking into these optical camouflage techniques. And so, you know, that's in the private domain. It's not in the public domain. But there is a tremendous amount of interest in the scientific field of just coming up to this solution because it's an interesting problem.
Yeah. Well, then let me, as we begin to close our conversation on our monthly science roundtable, we're getting toward the end of the year, and we're going to be hosting, by the end of the year, we're going to have a Rochester 2040 show in which we ask researchers, scientists, people who work in various fields, to look at what the world will be like in Rochester in 2040 based on changes in their field. And no one knows for sure. And this isn't meant to be, we're not going to hold anybody to this. But I'll start with you, John. Mm-hmm. 2040 is, we're going to be hitting 2040 25 years from now. How will work like yours or in this field change what is available to us?
I believe that cloaking will probably be fairly wide-based at that point, and that there will probably be, it might even be something the average person can have at that point.
A device at home?
Yes.
A mobile device, not just, again, blocking window or part of a building for insulation. We're talking a mobile cloaking device.
I believe so, yes.
Joe?
Yeah, I would agree with Professor Howell on this in terms of cloaking. Also, in terms of what we normally do in the lab in terms of quantum optics, we're trying to build a quantum computer. I think by then we might actually have a commercially powerful quantum computer by then as well, which could change our lives even more.
That's a whole other subject.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But again, by 2040, you agree with that, Professor Howell?
Well, I am not quite as optimistic on the quantum computing. It's a pretty hard problem that I worked on for a while, but it's possible.
Will you be able to walk into a store and purchase a cloaking device? Where will you get them?
Well, that's a good question.
Will they be affordable?
I believe so. When you mean affordable, I think they could probably be made for under $10,000.
That's not necessarily in the affordable range I was thinking, but
yeah. But it's not also it's not $1 million either, right? That's I think kind of the big.
Well, it's like anything with computing. When computers were really first available, they were not necessarily affordable. And now, just about anybody who works expects to have one.
Yes.
Same kind of thing.
Right. I can't even imagine my life without a computer.
There
right
you
now.
Go. So, very interesting things for us to think about. And thank you for sharing your scientific expertise with us this hour. Our thanks to Professor Alan Greenleaf, who is a professor of mathematics at the University of Rochester. John Howell is professor of physics and the director of the Center for Coherence and Quantum Optics. And Joseph Choi is a PhD student doing really interesting stuff, thinking about the ways our world is changing. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
And thanks for your questions and comments from our listeners this hour, challenging us to really stick with the technical as long as there's practical application, and that's where John and Joe come in. We'll see them again soon. Short break. James Lawrence from the Democrat and Chronicle is retiring this week as editor of the editorial page, and he joins us for the hour to talk about his career, what he's seen, and where newspapers go next. That's next hour on Connections.